Welcome to Recovery Radio by Landmark Recovery with your host, Zach Crouch. In this program, we'll discuss the root causes and treatments of alcohol and substance addiction, speak with experts in related fields, and help navigate the road to recovery. Now, here's the host of Recovery Radio, Zach Crouch.
Welcome to another episode of Landmark Recovery Radio. I'm Zach Crouch, and glad you're tuning in today. Thank you for tuning in. We do this every week. We put new content on the episodes. Want to have you guys a part of this and appreciate you. As you already know, Landmark Recovery Radio is your source for addiction and recovery news and knowledge. And you can find us online wherever you get your podcasts. So again, subscribe, tune in each week. We have a good one today. We have a really good one. We have guest Dr. Angela Husky joining us on the show. Dr. Husky is a PharmD, and she is the Senior Vice President and Chief Clinical Officer at Millennium Health. They are an accredited specialty laboratory with over a decade of experience in both medication monitoring and drug testing services. Her work has been featured in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it's really played a pivotal role in establishing the company's Emerging Threat Intelligence Program, which currently the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, along with some other state agencies, utilizes to help prevent drug overdoses and save lives. Can't wait to touch on that. Dr. Husky, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Zach. I appreciate being part of the show today.
You know, I always ask this question to our guests, and I love the answers that I get because they're just so varied. But for you, what got you interested in the field of addiction recovery? And if you don't mind, tell us a bit about your background.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to answer that question. Early in my career and prior to joining Millennium Health almost 10 years ago, I was a practicing clinician, and my specialty at the time was caring for patients with pain and comorbid substance use disorders. My interest in addiction disorders grew during that time in clinical practice, but for me became a true mission when a close family member was diagnosed with addiction and needed treatment. At that time, I dove into learning every single thing I could about addiction so that I could make my work even more meaningful, not only for my family member, but the substance use disorder community as a whole and within my job at Millennium.
Such a interesting sort of entrance right into this field. And I used to work at a hospital, so I ran a detox unit, and we would get phone calls from people who were quite desperate to come off of whatever pain medications that they were on for whatever reason. That, you know, there was a variety of reasons, but the doctors often what we found would not communicate with each other about any sort of pain schedule, especially pain management schedule, even if it wasn't narcotic, after the person got done doing a detox. And then on the front end, even if the doctor doing the detox was willing to take them off because he was looking for the doctor on the back end to make sure that this person gets taken care of. So it's a really sticky subject, you know, pain and comorbid disorders, because I think there's a lot of facets to it. But I found, at least to be true, that in my experience, that patients really listen. They don't really listen to people unless they have an MD or a doc, you know, some sort of practicing, physician kind of giving them information about their treatment and about suggestions that they should take. What's been your experience just in working with pain, in the field?
Well, like I said, I, you know, was in clinical practice a little over 10 years ago, and I probably experienced a lot of what you touched on, and that there are a lot of ways for those with comorbid disorders to sort of fall through the cracks, particularly if the clinicians are not coordinating the care. So I think one of the best things we can do for patients in the recovery side is ensure that their care is coordinated across all of their providers. Because as we know, and as we'll probably talk about in this podcast, you know, stressors are particularly what is going to cause a patient to relapse, whether it be mental health stressors, whether it be work stressors. And so without that coordination of care and somebody sort of looking across the whole patient, we certainly increase the chances of that person falling through the cracks.
Was, as I said in the intro, it sounds to me like you've had a really big part in this emerging threat intelligence program. And, you know, it's gaining some, it sounds like a lot of traction with U.S. Department of Health and Human Services using it. And some of the these state agencies, you know, what is it, first of all? And why did it get started with the program? What is it doing today?
Thank you. The Emerging Threats Intelligence Program is really sort of my passion today. And it came out of, in my role at Millennium over, you know, the 10 years or so that I've been able to see drug trends and drug test results. You know, I would watch drug use shift from substance to substance. I would see pockets of use in one region, very different from other regions. And often ahead of hearing about those problems from the traditional sources of data, like, you know, overdoses or deaths or hospitalizations or confiscations, because we were seeing what people were using in real time, we would see problems before often they were reported or before often they would cause overdoses. So we'd see big pockets of positivity in a place where maybe that hadn't been reported. And I'll give you a couple of examples as we go through that. But I think it was really those observations that led my team and I to want to find a way to share what we were seeing in more real time in hopes that a more timely notification could have a positive impact on curbing those issues in the community. So the Millennium Health Emerging Threats Intelligence Program is a product of many years of work, a state-of-the-art lab, compassionate employees, and an investment in an innovative analytical team, but was officially launched about a year ago, as you mentioned, after the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services took notice of one of our publications where we were reporting regions with increasing positivity of cocaine and methamphetamine, which had been combined with fentanyl. And as you know, and your listeners probably know, that's an extremely dangerous combination that often the user doesn't know that their methamphetamine or cocaine has been laced with fentanyl. And so we were reporting that we had specimens with those combinations in it in regions where folks had not noticed that that was potentially a problem at the time. And so shortly after that, we announced our collaboration to provide the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services with ongoing biweekly real-time reports that would highlight the key changes in drug use trends, not only at the national level, but the state, and in even some cases, all the way down to county levels where there were problems. And you also mentioned, I think more recently, we've expanded that ETI program out to some state level organizations, such as the Ohio Department of Public Safety. We're working collaboratively with them to provide that important and timely drug trend data down at the local level for them, all the way to the county level. But, you know, I'd like to just say while our collaborations and publications and the things that you're allowing me to talk about today are exciting, we certainly don't lose sight of our ultimate goal, which is to help those with substance use disorder and really the passion behind developing those programs, because we're all concerned about the trends we're seeing in drug overdoses, pandemic or not, right? And the monumental impact that the pandemic has had has made that even particularly worse for patients with substance use disorders. And so if the information that we can provide can help raise awareness about what substances are being used and specifically where those substances are, we think that resources can be better allocated to help those communities.
So I had a guest on recently, and he's doing some great work in Canada. And he hit on just exactly what you said, which is that there's, right now, at least, as he pointed out, in Canada, there's really no heroin on the streets anymore, right? Yep. It's all fentanyl. And it's a lot of the time, most of the time, laced with other substances, which are really just, I mean, sometimes it's benzodiazepines, sometimes it's just some weird kind of substance that's in there. I'm curious with this emerging technology, this emerging threat intelligence program that you have going on in these different states, as you brought up, who are the stakeholders and the decision makers involved that are part of this process?
It depends on the groups that we work with. I mean, I brought up our most recent collaboration is with the Ohio Department of Public Safety, and the group that attends the meetings where our data is presented along with a lot of other data from other groups. Because I think our data is one piece, and where it is most effective is when groups come together and bring the other pieces that they have. So combining our data with things like confiscation data and hospitalization data and overdose data is where we've seen it be most effective. Sometimes it can help validate something that maybe the other data is indicating. Sometimes it can point to something quicker. But I would say the stakeholders tend to be pretty cross-collaborative in terms of regulators around laws. We know our data gets law enforcement. We've got folks on that team from the Attorney General's office. I mean, it really is a large stakeholders of those sorts of regulatory and law enforcement people that are working to curb the problem and allocate the resources needed.
Talk to us a little bit more about what you meant by, as you said, that you guys are able to see problems now in real time, because that's, I think, a really important thing. Because when you said that, I was thinking about, you have someone come into the ER, maybe they've overdosed, maybe this is the third or fourth or tenth time that they've been there, right?
Yeah.
But how is it different from what we're working with now or what we've historically worked with?
Yeah, so historically, the data that is used to indicate trends in drug use or the data that we've had available has been things like you just mentioned. Hospitalizations, overdoses, ER visits, deaths, and in order for that data to get out to the public and those who are, able to do something with it, it takes time. And so that data often is 6 months or a year or sometimes even longer before it gets out. And so you'll see reports of overdose deaths data in 2019, but you may not see that until 2021. And so while that data is useful, it's often lagging. And so I think what we provide and in the platform that we have built that is different is that I'm able to analyze the data on the tens of thousands of specimens a day as to what is in people's systems today. What is coming in those specimens? What are the combinations that are coming in? How does that differ from the specimens that came in last week, last month, and then even last year? And so I think it fills a gap in being a more timely indicator of what people are using today versus a lagging indicator of what caused the problem months ago or a year ago.
I don't know if this is applicable or not, but maybe you're not the right person to answer it. But what came up, is because you're talking about a lot of data, right? You're talking about a lot of information coming forward from all these different people. And I'm wondering, does this emerging threat intelligence program, does it take things like artificial intelligence and maybe even certain algorithms with all this information that's coming in, and does it help in terms of coming up with solutions to this problem?
Yeah, it does. Exactly that. And, I mentioned early on that, the reason that I'm able to do this is in part due to an investment in a pretty innovative platform so that we can do exactly what you mentioned, which is, produce algorithms and have some machine learning in there that helps us do some predictive analysis as to where these trends are going. And so when we started this program, we originally just reported out on things like, what are we seeing today and how does that compare to other days? we've advanced the program to where we're able to, in some cases, make predictions about where those trends are going, because we have so much data now in that database, years of doing this, that we can do that. And then I think the second part of your question was, how is that used to allocate resources?
Right.
In our collaboration with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, we know that they share that data with other departments, so that they can do exactly that. If we're able to tell them that we're seeing very high use of methamphetamine, for example, in a particular region of the country versus very high use of heroin or opioids, that requires a very different resource to curb it. Naloxone may be the resource that needs to be quickly deployed to regions where there's a lot of heroin or opioid overdoses, but that doesn't work in a region where there's a lot of methamphetamine overdoses. And so we know that they're using that data, at least in part, in combination with the other things that they have, to determine where to allocate resources.
Has the data that's come forward provided you guys and some of these frontline workers some aha moments that you didn't expect? Or did it sort of reinforce some things that you already knew that now you just know is absolutely the way to go with in terms of engaging this population?
Yeah, I think it does both, which I think is a real advantage to the data. In some cases, combined with perhaps maybe what a city or a regulatory authority already knows, about confiscations or drug trafficking areas or overdose deaths. In some cases, our data may help them to validate something that they already know. But I do think in other cases, and where it's been most valuable to some of the users of it, is that it's providing a more real-time signal. Yeah. As to what might be happening. And so, we may be able to tell from our data that there is high use of a certain substance in a certain area that maybe that was not known. And so they can sort of prepare to see, okay, is that just an early signal of it, or is it something that's going to get worse? And that's where some of the predictive ability of our data comes in. But yeah, I think it does both, to answer your question. In some cases, combined with other pieces, it's very validating, and in other cases, it's a very early signal to something that they find out later.
You brought up earlier that, the pandemic, I think that you said, has kind of thrown a wrench in this whole system, right?
Yeah.
And I'm curious to know, just in terms of, I know the program you work with collects a lot of data about health and addiction, substance use disorder, but what kinds of data have you all collected during the pandemic?
Yeah, the data we've collected during the pandemic is really an extension of the ongoing work that we've been talking about before the pandemic hit. But in the pandemic, we're looking at it more in a unique, targeted way because of what we all know, right? That this past year has presented unprecedented challenges, particularly for those with substance use disorder. And so we really wanted to better understand the pandemic effects on drug use. What we did first back in July is publish a study in the Journal of American Medical Association, co-authored with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, that specifically looked at a certain time period before COVID hit and then right after COVID, so that we could compare, was there an effect from COVID on drug use in this population? At that time, we reported that compared with the period before COVID was declared a national emergency, the population tested during the COVID period were about 20% more likely to test positive for cocaine, almost 70% more likely to test positive for fentanyl, about 30% more likely to test positive for heroin, and about 23% more likely to test positive for methamphetamine. So across the board for those substances, pre-COVID and immediately after COVID, we saw steep increases in drug use.
Right.
Now, that report was released in July, and we certainly, I don't know that any of us expected the pandemic and the isolation to continue as long as it has, but because it did, we wanted to know, you know, were these sustained effects? Were these just immediate effects of increases, or have they been sustained? And so our just released Volume 3 Signals Report expanded on that early pandemic analysis and looked at those trends all the way through December 31st, 2020. And so that report has just been released, and I would encourage anyone interested sort of in the topic of drug use during the pandemic to learn more about that report on our website at millenniumhealth.com/signals report. But I'll share a few highlights from you. We are continuing to see the increases in fentanyl and methamphetamine positivity nationally, which is certainly, as I said, something we were already seeing leading up to the pandemic, but it seems to have worsened, and it seems to have been sustained. I'll talk about in a little bit. It looks like heroin and cocaine have really gone back down. Those two have gone down to pre-pandemic levels or maybe even lower. And I think you mentioned that you've had other speakers on your show that have mentioned, you know, really heroin is sort of low on the list of what's being found now, but fentanyl and methamphetamine remain right to be high. I think the other thing that's really interesting that we're finding in the pandemic is that we're tracking remarkable differences in certain parts of the country. And we're seeing trends in drug use in places that are not traditionally known for that substance. And so while methamphetamine continues to be widely available and used in the Midwest and the West, where it was historically a huge problem in the 2000s, we're now seeing significant growth for methamphetamine in the Northeast. Hmm. And, you know, to your point about, is our data more validating, or does it give light bulb moments? You know, seeing the significant growth in the Northeast in our data is consistent with what we're hearing for law enforcement reports suggesting that drug traffickers are now seeking to expand into non-traditional markets like the Northeast. I think knowing that you've got listeners in Nevada, our analysis revealed a 300% increase in methamphetamine when you compare pre-COVID to during COVID, which was the second highest state with an increase in methamphetamine, at least in our data. And then maybe lastly, we're still very concerned, I think everyone is, about the trends with fentanyl, particularly in light of the devastating impact it's had on overdose deaths. You've likely heard that early indicators suggest that the U.S. is on track to record an all-time high for drug overdose in 2020. We'll probably see that data later this year. And that those deaths in that rate is largely led by the fentanyl-related deaths. Our recent data from the Signals Report shows that while overall positivity rates for fentanyl remain high in the eastern part of the country, the biggest growth is really in the western part. And four states in the Pacific area, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, and California, more than doubled their fentanyl positivity during the COVID period. And so maybe just in short, you know, we're seeing use of these substances, particularly fentanyl and methamphetamine, very high during COVID, and we're seeing that be sustained throughout the time period.
Got it. I had a question. I was wondering just with the fentanyl that you're seeing, you know, the guests that I had on previously talked about so much of this is coming from China, right?
Right.
And do you have any insight into like where these substances are coming from? Because I'm thinking about, you know, like, okay, if fentanyl's coming from, you know, China, does that mean that, you know, methamphetamine is coming from where?
Yeah, our data particularly would not indicate or track where it's coming from. You know, we hear that in our discussions with some of the collaborative groups that we work with, like the public safety departments and HHS. And I think, you know, China and Mexico, depending on which area of the country you're in, seem to be the places where most of this trafficking is coming from. But our data specifically would not tell that.
It tells me, you know, whoever is, you know, certain. I mean, I just made a note here. I was thinking about cartels must be pretty smart, you know, and if they are finding new markets, right, in the Northeast, I'm curious about the population of people that are showing up, you know, either to treatment or to the ER or wherever. you know, is there a particular market segment, you know, a certain kind of person who fits this description, you know, a person who normally was not using something like, you know, speed, methamphetamine, et cetera, before, but now you're just like, man, that's fascinating that, you know, this person is now starting to use.
Yeah. I don't have great data on that. I can speak anecdotally because, you know, we speak with our clients across the country. I've got clinical and medical people in the field that keep a close eye on some of this. So I don't have data necessarily to support it, but I think that we would be surprised or many folks would be surprised about who the drug user is today. I think also the pandemic has created a scenario by which often someone cannot get their substance of preference. And so they may use whatever they can get. And so we hear and we see a shift in use from one substance to another, particularly now, based on what's available. As I mentioned, we know that sort of cocaine and heroin use has gone back to maybe what were levels before the pandemic or even lower, where fentanyl and methamphetamine use has gone up. And we also know that probably overall, the percentage of people using has remained about the same. So,
Dr. Husky, I was thinking too, just about that comment. And would you say that it's largely due to economics, right? Because it's cheap.
Yeah,
you know?
I think largely due to economics, but I think user habits changed. I think social isolation causes things, but I also think users now may be seeking substances online where perhaps they could go get something. So I think, you know, economics could be one, but also availability and accessibility are probably driving drugs of choice today.
Makes sense. How do you see this information helping or informing really, treatment organizations or the approach that, you know, that the folks that work in these places are taking to help these people out?
The information from our database? Yeah, I think, our hopes are that it's timely, relevant, current information that allows, you know, clinicians to understand maybe what they should be looking for, what they should be discussing, and also allows public health officials to focus on treatment and prevention efforts. So if we can give a little bit of insight into what people are using today before it causes an enormous amount of drug overdoses or deaths, perhaps prevention strategies can be launched more focused to those issues. That's really our hopes with the program.
I think that's a good place to stop. You know, I think that the more information that we have, right, the better that we can do for these folks and for the families and the kids that are involved. So, Dr. Husky, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been a real pleasure. It's been an eye-opening discussion. It really has.
Thank you, Zach. I appreciate you allowing me to get this information to your listeners.
And again, if they want to check that out, if they want to check out the work that you guys are doing, where do they need to go again? Is it millenniumhealth.com?
Correct. /signals report.
Awesome. I always end the show by saying, if you know someone who is struggling with an addiction and you're searching for answers, you can also visit us at landmarkrecovery.com. In there, you're going to learn a lot more about substance abuse programs that are both saving lives and empowering families. And until next week, Zach Crouch with Landmark Recovery Radio, wishing you guys well. Take care, everybody.
Thank you for tuning in to Recovery Radio. New content for this program is available every Tuesday at 12 noon Eastern Time and 9 a.m. Pacific Time, with all episodes available on demand on the Voice America Health and Wellness channel and through our content partners, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play Podcasts. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review so we can continue to create quality content to help save 1 million lives in the next 100 years. You don't need to struggle through addiction alone. Live the life you've dreamed on the road to recovery.